This is basically what you could take home tonight and review for next week for homework. Okay, it's just a review of all of Shmuel Bet, perek by perek.
Okay.
And gives you an introduction of the entire sefer, and just a brief, and only one perek I gave you. If you look in the middle, actual source material is the story of David and Bathsheba. Obviously, have to spend some good time on that when you get up to it. It gives you just about every Gemara and every Medrash written on that towards the middle of the Choveret there. Okay? But for today, we are in. I'm thinking maybe I'll make up have little folders for this, because I'm going to be giving you a lot of material over this time. This is our schedule. Right? Today's called for Bridge Between Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet. Okay? Shmuel Aleph is the story of the birth of Shmuel, the introduction of Shaul, till the death of Shaul. Right? Eli's leadership is transferred to Shmuel, Shmuel's to Shaul, and Shaul's to David. The first three happen in Shmuel Aleph, the second happens in Shmuel Bet. Okay. In the very beginning of this sefer, we'll see story after story that paves the way for David's exclusive rulership over the entire nation. And as those things happen, they're supposed to be good news for David, but David does not take them as good news. The death of Shaul, the death of Yonatan, the death of Avner, the death of Ishbosheth, all of these deaths should really be like a Shechianu for David. But David has to show that he is not happy with these things, even though they're personally good for him. So it's like a Baruch Dynamis for him, and we'll show each one in place how David reacts to these. Today we'll discuss the first one, David's reaction to the death of Shaul and Yonatan. Paradoxically, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos that Chas V'Shalom, we shouldn't want to think of such a thing, but if someone loses a parent from whom they will inherit money, the Mishnah says, Omer Shtei Brachot, Baruch Dayan HaEmet, Baruch Shechiyonu V'Kimonu V'Giyonu L'Zman HaZeh.
Wow.
One over the loss of a parent, one over the news of the inheritance. However, the poskim on this mishnah, that's what it seems, that he makes both brachas simultaneously. The poskim, however, say that he should wait to say the bracha, the shechianu. Now there are different opinions how long to wait. One, either wait till you're no longer an onen, for goodness sakes, you're potter for mitzvahs, you have to make this mitzvah. Two, wait till after the funeral at least. Two, wait till after the shiva. Or three, another opinion says, wait till you actually inherit the money. So,
there's no appeal.
Could be a fight. You know? Okay, anyway, but this is a similar situation as we have here. David has a Shechianu, he's about to be king, right? But it's a, whether they used to say in England, the king is dead, long live the king, right? So, but he just lost his father-in-law. But remember, to the people to a particular person in the story, he thinks David is going to be thrilled over this news over the death of Shaul, right? Because he tried to kill you, he's your enemy, right? David kills him. When the news goes out in Israel that David would be happy with the death of Avner, after all, it's only because of Avner that David wasn't king earlier in Shmuel Bet, that he went and crowned Ishbosheth as king instead of David, right? Why would Avner, a seasoned general, an important person, why would he do something so egregious as to appoint someone so unsuited for kingship as Ishbosheth instead of appointing David? Three reasons appear in Tosfos. Tosfos asks this question in Sanhedrin. Why would Avner, such a tzaddik in Chazal, why would he flout David, who is obviously a better choice for king, and make Ishbosheth king instead of David? What do you think?
He loses his position.
Right. That's one thing. You know, that you can look at that as in a cynical way, and I remind you that this course has a subtitle, Political Messages from Shmuel Bet. This is a political season this year, and at the end of the year, we're going to learn that the one who learns this message will be the next president. No, I'm not kidding. There's about security, about morals, everything is the various parties of should learn from Shmuel Bet, because look, every message that you need to know in life comes someplace in Tanakh. Political messages as well. So Avner, I mean, you don't have to be so cynical. Avner is loyal. Shaul was my king, and I'm going to be loyal to his son. If I have the opportunity to appoint his son king, I will. Now, you want to be cynical, Avner and Ishbosheth are first cousins. All right, they're relatives. Of course he's going to have it better. Who do you vote for? Someone who's better for your wallet or someone who's better for the country? I don't know, people, I can hear the arguments. I personally vote for who's better for Israel. Right? So, why? Because I am sure that that's better for this country and better for the whole world. I'm being selfish about that. What's better for Israel is better for the world. Well, that's what I still say. Okay, so a third reason, however, is brought out in Tosfos. A beautiful, beautiful reason. Listen to this, don't forget it. When Yaakov had 11 sons, Hashem told him, Umlochim mechalotzecha yetzeyu. Kings shall emanate from you. The Gemara says, Tosfos brings down this medrash, that it was a promise that at least two, Lochim is plural, that two kings would come from a son not yet born. It's like an oracle, a prophecy, that Shevet Binyamin must have two kings. One is Shaul, and the second is his son Ishbosheth. So if anyone asks you a trivia question, who was the second king of Israel? The answer is not David. The answer is Ishbosheth. What's he doing naming a child that? We'll learn that in chapter 4. All right. What kind of name is Ishbosheth? Who would name a child Ishbosheth? Right? But we'll discuss that. Okay, so in chapter 1, David is about to learn that Shaul is dead. I want to learn chapter 1 first, and then go back to learn the last chapter of Perek Lamed of Shmuel Aleph. Does everyone have? You should have two things. One is this long page back and forth, and two, the Choveret that gives you the chapters. Okay, so let's start with. Should look where there's a Lamed Aleph, but let's start with Shmuel Bet Pasuk Aleph at the bottom of the page. Everyone see it? Vayhi acharei mot Shaul. Shaul is dead, by all accounts, by this time. V'David shav mehakot et ha'amalek, v'yeshev dov b'tziklog yomim shnayim. The Amalekim, while David was busy fighting the Plishtim, the Amalekim were attacked David's families and took all the women and children, took them captive. David fought them and returned all the captives. That was the story just before this. So that's what this is referring to. Okay, simple enough. Vayehi, now you can turn over. Vayom hashlishi. Vihinei ish bo min ha-machane me'im Shaul uvegodov kru'im va'adama al rosho. A man returned from battle with torn clothes and soil on his head. Now, these are the signs of mourning. Wouldn't you say? This person is not just disheveled, he seems to be mourning. He recognizes David, knows what David's station is, and he bows to him. Vayomelo David, Emi Zetavo. Where are you coming from? Vayomer elav mi machane Yisrael nimlotiti. I have escaped. Not that I just was passing by, but I escaped from the camp of Israel. Vayomer elav David, meha yahadavar hagednali. Tell me what's going on. I don't have text messages. Tell me how was the battle? Vayomer asher nos ha'am min hamilchama. The people have all begun to escape from the battle. Vegam harbei nafal min ha'am vayamusu. Many have fallen and have died. Vegam Shaul vihonas son beno mesu. Chazal learned from here that when you have bad news to tell, blunt it, softly. Don't tell the worst news first. Tell it softly, slowly, slowly. Remember the Gemara we just did in Pesachim on Shabbos, where Rav asked about his parents he had not seen in over a year. So he says, how's my mother doing? And he said, why don't you ask about your father? And he said, how's my father doing? Why don't you ask about your mother? And he understood that they had both passed away. Plus, you shouldn't want to be the bearer of bad news, but this kid didn't know that Gemara. But he does report it in a way that slowly, slowly eases his way into the worst news, which to David is Yonatan mate, because remember how Ahava She'enat Liyavadavar, it's his best friend. Vayomer David al Hana'ar HaMagidlo. He told the Na'ar who was... Now these two words, Hamagidlo, are going to be important. They're going to show up again in chapter 4. Hamagidlo, he told him this. Just say, Vemer David al Hana'ar. What do you have to say, Hamagidlo? He said to the Na'ar, Eich yodato ki meis sha'ol bihona son beno. How do you know? Now notice that David also refers to him just as sha'ol bihona son. You should say Hamelech, right? You know why it doesn't say Hamelech?
Because he hadn't used those words.
Because Tanakh never uses those words. Did you know that if you took out a concordance and looked up the word Sha'ul, only once in the entire Tanakh does it come next to the word Melech.
When he was first.
And you'll never believe it, where it is. The Malbim says a big chiddush in that one place. He's aware of that. Imagine such Bekiyas. He must have read through the story a few times, right? And he saw that the Tanakh never says the words Shaul HaMelech or HaMelech Shaul except once. Where is that?
There is another Shaul HaMelech in Bereshit, Shaul Ben Aknani. That's another one.
Okay, but...
He was the Melech.
Okay, in the Tanami. but I'm talking here in Sefer Shmuel. But it never says the words Shaul HaMelech or HaMelech Shaul. Because the author of this book, Shmuel... By the time he got finished, he didn't think much of him as king. He's just always Shaul. As opposed to David, who appears many scores of times, HaMelech, David HaMelech. But first try to figure, where is the only time where it says HaMelech Shaul? Not Shaul HaMelech, but HaMelech Shaul.
By the necromancer?
No. No, it's the least place you'd expect to find it.
Mr. Freeman.
Okay. I wouldn't expect someone to know, but it's. I'm saying it's because the least place when the dancing girls came back after David killed Goliath, and it says, and they came to sing before David and HaMelech Shaul, and they said, "Hikah Shaul ba'alafav, the David b'ravavotav." So you can ask, what of all the places to write HaMelech Shaul? Why there? So the Malbim suggests to teach that they were not coming to speak, to denigrate the king, but Shaul felt so incompetent as king, as if though these dancing girls can determine who gets 100, who gets 1,000, who gets 10,000. Adarabba, says the Malbim. Listen to the words. He calls Shaul ba'alafav. What Shaul does with an army of 1,000... He cut David berivavotav. David does with an army of 10,000. They're praising Shaul 10 times as much. It's just that he was so paranoid, he was so worried about his own kingship, that he put into their words what they didn't say. Right. He cut Shaul alafav David berivavotav would mean that they're giving them. And he said, "Oh, look at them! They're praising him 10 times as much as me, and maybe they'll give him the malchus as if though they could." No, but in Shaul's mind, they could. Right? So that's the only time that the word HaMelech and Shaul come together. But I would think that this Na'ar, who we're going to find out soon, ironically, is an Amaleki, right? Right? Shaul, at one time earlier in his life, had pity on a wicked king and let him live. And here, Shaul's death comes at the hands of a kid who claims that he pitied him. I saw him suffering. What was I to do? So I killed him. Right? So it's just an irony about how he dies. So here he says, he tells him, don't be surprised that they keep calling him Shaul and Yonatan, because that's the way it goes in Shmuel. Ve'emer ha'na'ar ha'magidlo, again ha'magidlo. Why does he have to say that? Just say ve'emer ha'na'ar. Aren't you intrigued by this time why he keeps saying ha'magidlo? Would I miss anything if I didn't have those two words in the Bible? Right? Ve'emer ha'na'ar ha'magidlo. Nikro nikresi bahar ha'gilboa. Now, usually, nikro nikresi should be with a hey. Nikro means I just happened to be there. Right? The English translation here says, I happened to be at Mount Gilboa. Don't be so surprised, sometimes Tanakh spells this word with an aleph, like in the beginning of Sefer Shmot, where Moshe refers to being called by God, and he says it's spelled with an aleph. Okay. But whatever it means I was called to be there or I happened to be there. To say I was called should be with an aleph. To say I happened to be there, davar kara, is with a hey. Right? You hear the Hebrew? Okay. And don't be so surprised. It's alephs and hays sometimes do this. And if that's what it's doing here, it's okay.
So would the word nikreti be...
I just happened to be like vayikra mikreha. Where is that here? Remember? Vikra Mikreha, by root, where she happens to go to Boaz's field. Same terminology.
This is a conjugation of the kara with the hay.
Yeah, absolutely. Kol asher karahu. That's the pshat. There are lots of drashas about these things.
The biggest proof is Nikreti, the hay changes to yud.
No, good. Right. If that was an olive, it should have been with an olive there.
That's right.
Absolutely. Behar HaGilboa, v'hinei Shaul nish'on al chanito. What is a chanit?
A spear.
He was leaning on a spear. V'hinei harechev abal ha'parashim hidbikuhu. And I already saw that the chariots, they were all on top of him. Hidbikuhu means they're pressing on him already. Right? V'yifen acharo v'yir'eini. He turned around and he saw me. V'yikor elai v'omar hineini. He called to me and I said, I am here. V'yimali mi'ata. Now, why would Shaul say this? What is Shaul afraid of right now?
His body being exploited by the
Plishtim were terrible exploiters of their captives. We know that from their sources, and we know that from another story in Sefer Shoftim, namely Shimshon. When they captured a person of influence, they would take him and rip him apart slowly over a period of weeks to the merriment of their what the Romans did, you know, with animals and what they would do to a living king of Israel caught was so beyond the what anyone could hope to be able to even survive. So that is why Shaul is at least considered justified in taking his own life. I don't know if we have time tonight to deal with suicide based on what we'll read shortly in Perek Lamed Aleph. But Shaul wants to die before the Plishtim capture him. Chalila, look what they did with his body when they caught him dead. They did terrible, despicable things to him. I'm not talking mentors, I'm talking about what's written, what we'll read in Shmuel Aleph. Right? So would you start asking him, who are you? Are you a Philistine? All right, maybe he did. V'yomali miyata, and he said to me, who are you? V'omar elav amaleki anochi. I am an amaleki. I must not have said well with him, but okay, I told him I'm an amaleki. V'yomar elai, amodno alai umosiseni, ki achazani hashavots. Stand upon me and kill me, do a sure job of it. Why is he so? Why is he saying? He says, "Do a sure because I tried this already. I asked back in Perek Lamed Aleph. I'm going to do this though. But he already asked his armor bearer back in chapter 31 to kill him. He didn't want to. He fell on his own sword. That didn't do it. Right. So he says, now please do it and finish me off. Ki hazani hashavatz. Shavatz is a hapax legamina. It means ein lamilazu chaver betanach. So it usually means agony, is usually how it's translated. The throes of death is what the English here says. You only know what it can mean from the context of the word. All right? Okay, so the agony has gripped me. I only have a moment left to live. Don't let them capture me. Kicholod nafshivi. V'amola lava amosisehu. So I stood above him, and I finished him off. Ki yodati ki lo yichya acharei niflo. He could not live after this. Even if we were hoping for a miracle, even if we say afilu cherev chado munach al tzavarecha al yimna atzmacha min arachamim, you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Al chizkiyahu nema, right? Even if the sword is at your throat, don't. He said he learned it from David. Don't give up hope. My father can tell you 100 times where he thought it was curtains. Shema Yisrael, and each time he managed. Don't give in. If there's hope, if there's some kind of possibility, very even remote, that I can survive this. But the way I saw him, he wasn't going to live past that. And even if he could, the Philistines were right on top of him. I had to do it. Yodati ki lo yichya acharei niflo. V'akach ha-nezer asher al rosho, v'etzada asher al ro'o, v'aviyem el aduni heina. So I took his crown and his bracelets that his king wears, and here they are. Now that's indisputable. Whether he's lying about anything until now, I don't know. Whether David recognized them as Shaul's crown, but what is in it for this kid? What does he expect to get from David by presenting? He could go to a pawn shop and get lots of good money for this crown and bracelets.
Yeah.
What does he want from David here?
Reward, position.
Absolutely. He thinks he's going to get more than this crown and bracelets by presenting the death of the man who's keeping you from being king and the one who wanted you dead so long. Or perhaps gloating inside of against the man who possibly killed some of my relatives. Right?
But doesn't he know that David just went and killed...
I don't know if he has this book in front of him. Okay. So he says... So I took the crown and the two bracelets and I gave it to him. And here I'm giving it to you. All right. Now turn back, please. Is this boy telling the truth or not? And if you were in that circumstance, what would you do? Say, no, I'll let the Philistines finish you off. I mean, what do you do? Is there any winning in this situation? I mean, his mistake seems to be, why go to David with this? Right? I mean, he does have the bracelets and the crown, which seems to imply that there's some bit of truth to what he's saying. And furthermore, if you were the king and you were hiding from the Philistines, would you be wearing your crown?
Could be had on.
Yeah, all right. Could
a knapsack or something.
Wouldn't you be like hiding it or trying to be someone else? That could be. I don't know. But let's see what it says in Perek Lamed Aleph. The Plishtim nilchamim beYisrael. The Plishtim were fighting. Beyanusu anshei Yisrael mipnei Plishtim beyiplu chalalim b'harag Gilboa. Just as the boy described, everyone's running away. Vayad biku Plishtim es Shaul. The same word he uses. It biku, right? They pressed upon him. As Shaul v'esbanav, v'yakup plishtim as Yohanan v'savinada v'smalkishua b'nei Shaul. When the boy spoke about who died, he only mentioned Yohanan because he knew that that's what David cared about most. But all three sons of Shaul were killed. V'tichbara milchama el Shaul v'yimtza'u ha-morim. Now it's very crucial to figure out what this means. V'yimtza'uhu ha-morim. Maze. Morim are archers, people who are yoreh, with chetz. Right? With arrows. What does Vayim Tsa'uhu mean? The English here says the archers found him. Now, from the time that the archers found him, after all, how far can you shoot an arrow? It must be, how many yards can it be? How long would it take from the time they found him, maybe his hiding space? Some of Farshim even say Vayim Tsa'uhu Amorim means they found him with they're arrows. Vayimtzu amorim means arrows started to hit him. Right? A hundred of them are shooting arrows. One or two hit him.
But morim is arrows?
Morim are archers.
Oh, the archer found him.
Yeah, right. Some mafarshim take that
to
mean
found him.
Their arrows found him.
Right.
Right? So, Vayimtzu amorim anoshim bakoshes vayochel ma'od mehamorim. And he became extremely... Now, peyochel can mean a lot of things too. Also, usually it means he was very frightful. V'yemar Shaul anosei keilov, shlof charbacha v'dokreini ba. By the way, do you remember what the boy said he was leaning on that made him think he was mortally wounded?
Chanit.
That's a spear. So here it says, shlof charbacha v'dokreini ba. Turn your sword against me and stab me. Lest they finish me off. I know I'm going to die, but at least I'd rather die here and say Shema Yisrael or something and then have my last words, rather than be Hisalalubi, rather than they should come and torture me. So there is a Gemara in Meseches Baba Kama, Daf Tzadik Aleph, that says, from this week's Parsha, Ach et dimchem edrosh mikem. I will hold you responsible for your own blood. That's how the Gemara learns, not only lo tirtzach someone else, but lo tirtzach yourself. Right? Ach eftimchem edrosh mikem. Right? So that's coming to prohibit hachonek et atzmo. Can't take your own life. It's not yours.
Where is that from?
Baba Kama Daf Tzadik Aleph.
Is where
now,
it says that?
Where it says this drosha. That
I'll hold you responsible.
Your own blood. Ach et dimchem.
Yeah, but where are they getting that from?
That pasuk is per test pasuk in this week's parsha. Now, this is the Gemara stops there. What picks up is Bereishis Rabbah on the parsha and says, Yachol kishaul? Cryptic. What does Yachol kishaul mean? Talmud Lomar, ach. That's it. That's the whole discussion in the Medrash on suicide. Yochol kishaul, Talmud lomar, ach. So, ach is a delimiting. Gam and et come to add things. Ach comes to delimit.
It's not included.
That's how almost all of the Mephoroshim, except for Sadia Gaon, understand the Medrash to mean. Is Sha'ul also, what he did, prohibited by this Pasuk?
No.
Talmud Lomar, ach. If you're in a circumstance like Sha'ul, you are within your rights to prevent the Chil Hashem entailed in what they're doing. This is I'm not going to discuss assisted suicide and all this. It's never allowed from someone else.
Yeah, but he's a king.
Because he's a king. Yeah. The Radak adds something else to this equation. The Radak says that the day before, what had Shaul heard? Three important words he heard from a witch. Now, whether or not she was actually telling the truth, most Mefarshim there, especially the Sephardic Mefarshim, Chofni, Sadugon, and Ralbag, and Radak, and Ibn Ezra, they all say that whatever he heard at that table, where he called Shmuel back from the dead to ask what would happen in the battle with the Plishtim, was all bogus and fake and nonsense. That doesn't matter. He thought it was real. I'll tell you, Rashi, Gemara Pesachim, says that it was real. Right? It was real because Hashem did it for her. No human being has the power to raise someone from the dead. It was Hashem who did it. That's why she was so frightened. That's why she screamed. Because she said, oh my goodness, every time this was bogus, but this time I think I really did it. What's going on here? Right? Okay? Because it's so uncanny, because if it was bogus, how is she so right about everything that was said under the table by that man who made himself sound like a ghost? He said everything right. With a chutzpah to say the three words I'm thinking of, Machar, Ata, Imi. Tomorrow you are with me. Where I am, in the Olam HaEmes, that's where you'll be. So Shaul understood this. He knew it. So that's also has to be added to the equation, says the Radak. You see, I'll just tell you what's happening here. The Balei HaTosfos had to deal with the fact that in throughout Europe, Jews were killing themselves rather than being given over to the Crusades. Right? The Rambam was very much against that. The Rambam writes in the Luchos Yesodei HaTorah that it's you're committing suicide. Don't do it. Let them take you. And then you'll try to escape, says some years later. You'll secretly fast on Yom Kippur. You'll secretly try to keep Shabbos. Whatever they force you to do, you're at least alive and you live. Unless they force you to do three things publicly and they force you to do it. But you can eat treif. You can violate Yom Kippur. You can violate Shabbos. Right? And so anyway, the Balei HaTosfos had to deal with this issue of masses of Jews. And if you have a chance to see a very chilling parish, a parish of Balei HaTosfos, there's a parish in the Torah called Da'as Kein Mibalei HaTosfos. On that pasuk, it's a very long page, it takes up half a page. Right. And on this pasuk, Achas Dimchem et Rosh Mikem, he talks about various crusades and what's going on in Europe with the threats. So it's not just that they'll torture me. They'll torture me, I'm king. Plus, I would go through all that torture if there's a possibility that some army of ours could be able to defeat them and redeem me and take me. In the end, there were some people who captured their bodies and brought them back to be buried in Givat Shaul. People from, remember, the city he helped? Yavesh Gila, the people that were threatened with their right eyes. He helped them and he saved them. So those people took down the bodies and brought them back for burial. So if he had hoped that maybe someone will torture me, they'll pluck me apart, but before they finish me off, maybe some soldiers of valor will save me. I'll accept the torture for that. But he there's no point to it. Because he was convinced, Machar ata imi, tomorrow you're with me. You hear it? Okay, so let's go back to here. So it says Shlof Charbacha, lest these arelim ha'ele udukaruni visalalubi. The armor bearer did not want to take his king's life. So he took the sword and he fell on it. Does that make the kid a liar for saying that I saw him lying on a spear?
No.
Okay, he called the sword a spear. He wasn't makbi, he wasn't medaktik. Right? Is there a better reason why you think he's a liar? And can you prove that David thinks he's a liar? The Magid law, I think, is damning evidence. But you know what? I don't know from Perek Aleph with conclusion. I know from Perek Dalet that David thought he was a liar. I'll just tell it to you now. In Perek Dalet, two men break into the palace of Ishbosheth and make believe that they're selling wheat. You know, it's like a typical, you've seen this, I'm sure, in some kind of a book. The wheat sellers come to the door and they're hiding out, kill them, put on their clothes, take the wheat and say, and then they knock on the door and they say, who's there? He goes, we have your order, the wheat is here, right? Or your pizza's here, whatever. And they make their way into the palace. They bring the wheat to the kitchen, and then they kill who is ever in the kitchen, and then they quickly make their way into the king's room where he's sleeping in the afternoon. And sleeping in the afternoon is not a good thing to do in the Tanakh. Whoever sleeps in the afternoon gets trouble. See, four times in Tanakh, someone sleeping in the afternoon, trouble. So it says, and then it starts calling them with feminine pronouns. So the Medrash says they dressed up as women. They dressed up as women to get out. How did they get out? Just killed the king. Probably the fire alarms were off already. And then they presented David with the king's head. How did they get out of the palace with the king's head? So I once asked this question to my 7th grade class at MDS, and one kid came up with a brilliant idea. Right? They said they may believe they were pregnant. One of them did. How do you get out of a palace with the king's head? Anyway, when you present the head to the king, to David, they thought, oh, David's going to give us a big mishaberach. We killed it. And they said to him, this is your enemy and the son of your enemy. Now you're king over all of Israel. So this is what David said, one of the 10 Kal Vachomers in Tanakh. Right? Rashi refers a few times in his parish to 10 Kal Vachomers. This is one of them. He said, that kid back earlier who was just informing me, he was just a magidli, and I killed him. How much more so will I kill someone who actually killed the king? He didn't think the kid killed him. And I don't think so either. There's too many holes in the story. Because if in Perek Lamed Aleph it says the archers already found him, the archers wouldn't have let him get in there and finish off the king and take his bracelet and his crown in the time it takes between finding a man with your arrows and getting up to him. How much time is that? 2 minutes? How far does it take to shoot an arrow? Right. Yes.
So then, you know, other places in the text you get hints. Here we're just imputing it, so why doesn't the text say that?
This is the way that Tanakh works. The boy thinks he's being honest, he thinks he's being upright. Look, he could have gone to a pawn shop with that. Just a bad decision on his part. Now if you're telling me this, so if this is what you want to say, then what I have to do is give you like a good lawyer show. I don't know how they do this. Tell me what actually happened then. Uh-huh. Give me a better picture of what happened. What happened is that Shaul probably ditched his crown and his bracelet someplace. On his way to his hiding place, he probably threw them someplace. He found them and thought that he could curry favor with David by making up a story. He might have even seen him from afar, or maybe looked through the window and saw, oh my goodness, that's the king. This must be his crown and his bracelets. I'm not even done to hide this.
If
right?
He wanted to make a better story, why didn't he kill him? No, he said Shaul asked me to kill him. Why didn't he just say I killed him?
I might think, I don't know, he might think that would just simply wouldn't go over, I don't know.
The story is close to what happened also, very close to what happened.
Yeah, another one. He may have actually watched all this happen, and hiding out someplace, right?
Why did David kill him?
I think here we're going to now find out something about David. In all three stories that pave his way to be the king of Israel, the death of Avner, the death of Shaul and Yonatan, the death of Avner, and the death of Ishbosheth. Right? I think David acts honorably in all three stories, but understands he is a public figure, about to be much more public, and is aware of the necessity to act in a certain way, especially when it comes to the death of Avner. He would have probably killed the one who killed Avner, if not for the fact that it was his sister's son, Yoav. Right? which starts a trend in Shmuel Bet about Yoav's misbehavior again and again and again as far as David is concerned, but we'll deal with that separately. But David realizes he is a public figure and he has to act in a certain way. And look, you know what? The Radak says, I have trouble with how David killed him. You know why he killed him? Because he was Amaleki.
Right, because in the Ish-Boshet incident, it seems obviously
justified. He acknowledges he's an Amalek. Now, you know, he's going to say shortly that he's a Ger Amalek. He's the son of a man who converted from Amalek. Rashi says in a few places in his parish that Amalek can convert. Only Ammon and Moab can't convert. Amalekim, if they want to keep 7 mitzvahs from Noach or keep 613 mitzvahs and convert, they can become Jewish. Right? It's just that he killed him for this. Then Rashi cites a psikta. It's just something amazing. Have you heard this? If you never heard this, you're just going to get it. But if you heard it, you say, okay, that it was Doeg HaAdomi. Have you heard this? Very beginning of Rashi. He cites the psikta that this Amaleki was Doeg HaAdomi. Now, it's very bizarre. Rashi himself doesn't usually do something like this. Why cite a psikta and then write, but the story does not seem to bear this out at all? Just don't write anything then. Rashi doesn't disagree with, write every measure she did, he disagrees with. Right? So try to explain to me, why would Rashi cite the psikta that it was Doeg HaAdomi and then say, but the storyline calling him a Na'ar and everything else, Amalek and Edom are mixed up sometimes in some stories. There's no question about it in Chazal. Right? But why do such a thing? You know what I'm saying? Why cite? Rashi doesn't cite every medrash in the world.
Because he thinks it serves a purpose to
say it was. Because there's some purpose to it. Because he realizes that it is a problem for why he killed him. The boy seems to be acting with lefitumo. All right, David, wait. Before you kill me. Hold up. Don't kill me yet. What should I have done?
What
should I have done?
Running to the Rosh.
What should I have done? He was. I wanted to spare him from the agony that he asked himself. Okay, good. Let's go back to Lamed Aleph and look at Pasuk. Look at Pasuk Dalet and Hey. It says, V'yomer Shaul l'nusei keilav, shlof charbacha v'dokreni ba. Take my sword. Shlof means give it a good zetz, because I don't want it to be just a stab. I'm a big, strong man. Kill me. Give a good zetz. I don't want that to them to have no life in me for when they come. So what did Shaul have to do? I got to do it myself. And he fell on his sword. Look what it doesn't say at the end of this pasuk. Because now look at the next pasuk. That's pretty clear. Vayipol gamhu al charbo, vayamas imo. This pasuk seems to go out of its way to say that he died with him, but it might be saying it from his standpoint. He looked at he died. I better die also. What good sword bearer doesn't die with his king, right? So the fact that pasuk dalid ended just vayipol aleha and it didn't say vayipol aleha vayamos like in the next pasuk. But look at pasuk vav vayamos shaul shloshes banav. Come on. Well, how could? I don't know. There's just too much. It's too much going on here. I think the kid is lying. I think he made up the story, and I think that David was so perceptive. There are other stories later in Shmuel Bet that David was very perceptive at these kind of things. He looked at the kid's face and saw this is a liar. He's a magidli, and David says so explicitly in chapter 4. Explicitly, he says, I'll tell you why I'm going to kill you, Rechav and Ba'ana, who were amazingly from Shevet Binyamin. They thought they were currying favor with David by killing Ish-Boshes. Right? And he said, I'll tell you why I'm going to kill you, a Kal v'chomer. Because when that boy just told me that he killed Shaul, I killed him. You, who actually did the deed, surely I'm going to kill you. That implies that he didn't think the boy actually killed him, and that he deserved to die for bragging about killing the king. That's it. Okay. There's no real political message yet. The name of the class is called Political Messages from the Book of Shmuel. Here's the political message as we continue in Shmuel Bet. Yes?
Wouldn't it be also in King David's favor to also set a precedent that any king who takes over is going to kill, you know, anyone who kills.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Even if the king before me had it out for me, I will acknowledge that that was part of some plan of God. There was something there to train me in some way or another. Some of my best tefillin were written then. Perek Nun through Perek Samach, right? So that is the those are the really desperate tefillin where David has the most faith because he knows he's going to survive if he's supposed to be king. Right? He's best friends with this king's son, he's married to this king's daughter, but the king wants to kill me. Okay, I'm not going to test fate. I'm not going to go on a high wire or cross on my standing on my head because I feel I have to be king. No, chas v'shalom. He's going to take every strategy to stay alive. But he has a lot of great faith, and those make up some really great tiller. Be that as it may, David is here. Look, throughout Shmuel Aleph, David never took for granted the position he had with the king's in the king's household. He never played on that he never told anyone that he intends to be king. Right? Even when Yonasan tells him, "I know you'll be king one day and not me," David never says, "You're right, God told me." He never says any. In fact, Abarbanel says brilliantly that the reason why his older brother spoke with him with such guile when he went to bring food to the front lines, remember that? He speaks with him with terror. How stupid can you be? You're not going to make duke after your brother becomes king, right? Why are you speaking with him with guile? So the Barbanel says brilliantly, he loved his brother. He wanted to draw attention away from him. He knew that if Shmuel secretly came to our house to crown one of my brothers king, right? Let me deflect attention from him and speak to him with derision. So that people all those stories about the Shmuel crowning him king, the brother would never talk to him that way if that happened. Right? To deflect attention away. There's one time in Shmuel Aleph where David let his guard down. One time. Where Shaul is talking to him across a ridge after he cut off the corner of his garment and he says, "David, I see that you're a tzaddik. You're right in all these things. I shouldn't be running after you. You're the good person. You've served me well. Just promise me that when you become king, you will not kill my children and grandchildren." Something that kings often did. Now, Johnny, you just said the exact opposite, because in Israel, we don't work that way. We support the previous king. We want everyone to know that I'm not happy with his death, even though it paves the way for me. And he's not my father. And he tried to kill me. Right? So, if you're David, and you were behaving in the way described until now, just now, what you should say after Shaul says that is,
"I'll never be king.
Of course I'm not going to be king. What are you talking about? How can you even think that? You keep telling me I'm supposed to be king. Your son is going to be the next king, my best friend Yonatan." Instead, what does David do? He says, "Okay, I promise." What a slip up. So that, get this, in Shmuel Bet, in chapter 9, when David says, "I would like to keep the promise I made to Yonatan to look after his children. Find me any children of his?"
Mephibosheth.
What's the relationship between Yonatan's sons and David? They are David's nephews. Why doesn't David know himself where his nephews are? They were hiding. They are mistaken, but they're scared of him. They think that he'll kill them. That's a mistake. It's a mistake made by this Amaleki boy in chapter 1. It's a mistake made by Rechav and Baner in chapter 4. Right? It's a mistake some people would make. But when he finally found him, and by the way, he mistreats him later, we'll see that. But for now, he looks after him and he says, "Where is..." But notice, he said, "I want to keep the promise I made to Yonatan to look after his sons." Wait a second, David, you made that promise to Shaul. He may have also made that promise to Yonatan, but he certainly made that promise to Shaul. He said, "I promise, I won't harm your children and grandchildren." So why does he say, "Let me keep my promise I made to Yonatan"? Because Shaul went back on his side. He says, "I will not chase after you anymore." And after David said, "I promise," He chased after him the next day because I know what happened that night in the palace. Did you hear what he said? I said, are we going to kill my grandchildren? And he said, I won't. There you go. He pretends to be king. So the next day, he went around chasing after him again to kill him so he doesn't become king. So Shaul, you didn't keep your side not to chase after him anymore. I owe you nothing. If I'm going to look after your grandchildren, it's not because of any promise I made to you, because you broke that. It's because of a promise I made to your son.
There's a much less cynical way also to look at David's behavior. Clearly, he didn't believe, even when it served his purpose, in anyone ever having the justification to kill a king. Because in the story you're alluding to, he did have the opportunity to kill Shaul, and he didn't.
Right.
He wouldn't touch him. So maybe he believed that no matter what the reason.
Oh, absolutely. He had lots of men amongst him, Yoav and his chevra, who thought that I want to kill you, so you kill him. He goes, and Chas v'Shalom, that's a Mashiach Hashem. Right, so that's why David behaves this way here, okay. So I think that in my opinion the evidence is in, especially given what he says in chapter 4, the Magidlo in chapter 1 a few times, the Chanit and the Charev I wouldn't have used as primary evidence, but he made it up. He was hoping that it was a Chanit, it wasn't, and David doesn't know the difference, but the reader does. It was a Charev that he fell on. He may have seen him from a window. He may have. I can't believe Shaul was wearing his crown at this time. He ditched him someplace. He threw him under the house, and the boy saw him do it. An irony that it was Namaleki. He took it and thought he'll get more favor from this than pawning it.
Some of the best evidence is it doesn't say it in the story.
That
it doesn't mention it in the actual story. It doesn't mention the Amaleki in the actual story.
Oh yeah, of course, right. Yeah, well, so that's an important point, is that Shmuel Bet wants to start off with an ironic break of everything in Shaul's past, and now let's one by one break from Shaul. Well, how is that? Yonatan and Ishbosheth and the other two sons. Michal is brought back to David. Avner leaves their side. No, the house falls apart and the king is assassinated. But also Michal coming back to him is an important point. Right? That's an important part of all this.
All right.
Yes, you've been patiently waiting.
Yeah, I have a question. In here, this young boy tells Saul that he's I am an Amalekite. And then when David asks him, he replies, I am the son of an Amalekite convert.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be different? That's my first question. And the second question is, why would Saul want to die at the hands of an Amalekite as opposed to dying at the hands of the Philistines? Like, what's the difference?
The Philistines would torture him and rip him apart. The Amalekite is a boy here who has some pity on him. That's all. Now, when he says Ger Amaleki, that means he is actually halachically a Jew. His father converted to Amalek, right? So he says, I'm the son of a convert to Amalek.
But why didn't he tell that to
Saul? Why didn't he say that in the outset? It's very possible that now fearing of what, now that he sees that David's reaction to this news is not one of joy, and wow, what a great,
right.
great news. Let me give you three times what this gold is worth and these jewels are worth. It's not what he saw. He said, Vayispedu, Vayivku, Vayatumu, right? There, he underlined it. Right. So they're all crying.
How did he felt inside? He probably was extremely happy.
I could not know.
He wrote Psalms against Shaul, terrible Psalms, where he can compare him to.
Whether those Psalms are about Shaul or not, I must insist, are up to Mephoshim. There's some Mephoshim, especially if you look at Perakuf Tes, which seems to be about Shaul, but it is so harsh. Some Mephoshim say, I never say this, Perak. It's too harsh. What David asks to happen, Kuf 109, to happen to his enemies. And it's quite evident that those enemies are not Philistines, those are Jewish enemies. Because he says, this is what I hope happens to them because they don't want to do chesed and they're not listening to Hashem. Why would he expect a Gentile to do those things? You know what I'm saying? Like Yirmiyahu Perek Yud Beis, where Yirmiyahu says, take them to the slaughter because they talk to you about you, God, in their hearts, in their mouths, but you're not in their hearts. Why would that be Nebuchadnezzar? Why would Nebuchadnezzar be condemned for not having God in his heart? Right? It's a difficulty, but anyway, I still answer you, Yaakov, that I can never know what was in David's heart. Right? But if you see on the side, you see I wrote, confer halacha hayoresh me'aviv mevorech shtayim. I wrote that there precisely because deep in the recesses of David's heart, is some kind of knowledge that with this news, I am now going to fulfill what Hashem told me is my destiny.
And finally asked his son, Shlomo, to kill all his enemies.
I intend to learn the beginning of Malachim Aleph as well, but yes.
There's definitely a political message. David knows he's going to be the next king, so he's setting up a situation. Don't ever cross the king. Look what happens.
Excellent point. That's an excellent point. Sometimes that, and it's not just politically smart. It's moral. It's just.
He's sending a message.
Right. It's just.
My time. I knew I was going to be king, but I wouldn't go out and kill the king.
Right. Listen.
I knew the moment would come when
absolutely.
I could step up.
There's a book in Tanakh where a navi spends much of his sefer. We discussed him a few weeks ago. Just simply blasting the kings of Israel, because four of the last six of them became king by killing the king before him. Listen, what you did to him could just as easily happen to you, right? Don't be saying, you know, like we sometimes see how a school fires a principal and then they hire a new one, and then be very careful, because if they fired that principal, they can just fire you just the same in a year or two, right? So be careful about how you ease into those kind of situations. So it's no question that David wants to express to these people, listen, this is how we treat the kings, and this is how it goes. That's a moral position, and one that David does very well in the Sefer. So just to review what we did today, today's topic was called The Bridge Between Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet. So we still have... today is the 24th. Right? We still have one more week in October, so I still want to talk about some of the other bridges of David's to pave the way, as we say, to David's reign. But we see here that there is certainly a political wisdom on David's part, but it is constantly, especially in the first four chapters, as he makes his way to be the undisputed king, a moral strain that can be seen throughout. That he wants to show everyone that he is that even though there is a shechianu to be made, my public persona is the Baruch Dynamis and the crying and the like. And what's interesting is that of all three or four times where this happens, the one that's most emphatic is Avner. The story of Avner's death. Because there, I have to, we'll see it inside. The average Israelite can think that David ordered the hit on Avner because it was his nephew who killed him. So David has to show. David doesn't have to show in this story that I was not behind the death of Shaul, or Ishbosheth for that matter. There he just has to show that I'm not happy with it. But in the death of Avner, he has to show that he did not order the hit on Avner. And then it says at the end of the story, after he mourned for Avner, and everybody in Israel knew that David did not order his death. So it's very clear from that David realizes what's at stake. So correct all this, and good. So we'll continue Mitzvah Hashem next week. It's very intense, as you can see. It will help to read these pages I gave out by next Monday.